This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we start something new with somebody who's been around for quite a few years on our show. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of the radio and online program Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today he joins us to start a new series of chats that occur every month here on Main Street. We're calling them Philosophical Currents. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
I'm super happy to be here, and I'm really excited about this project. I always have so much to say, and, you know, I want people to listen to me. But also, you're such a great interlocutor. I love getting the chance to talk to you and the chance to address the state, so I couldn't be happier.
Well, we were struggling with what should be our first topic, and then, of course, we ripped it right from the headlines because it's there. The March 23rd issue of The Atlantic says, quote, "While reports of hate crimes declined last year in 16 of America's largest cities, reports of those against Asian Americans surged nearly 150%. A Pew Research survey conducted in June, just a few months into the pandemic, found that an astonishing 31% of Asian Americans said they had experienced some form of discrimination since the pandemic began." Jack, hate crimes against Asian Americans have been in the headlines. How does a philosopher approach this kind of problem?
Well, the first thing is, I think, like you, I didn't know what to start with because I kind of wanted to talk about something happy, right? There's so much awfulness in the news. There's so much just darkness. But this is an urgent topic. And one of the best ways to talk about an urgent topic is to diffuse the situation, is to sort of walk away from the anger and the hostility. And philosophy does that really well, right? Philosophy can engage abstractly and try to bring the conversation out to its best, most general, most, you know, critical thinky kind of stuff. And I also was concerned because, of course, you and I, as far as I know about you, are not of Asian descent.
Correct.
And in our culture, when we want someone to advocate for a group, we almost always want to center someone who's a member of that group. And so there's already a philosophical difficulty, which is how much can a member of one subgroup understand or speak about or even speak for, advocate for a member of another group? And that's a huge issue. That's the issue of the time. And, you know, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and her generation is awash in the idea that representation is the single most important issue. And so there is something a little awkward about you and I having this conversation alone. On the other hand, that's the burden of being Prairie Public's resident philosopher.
Well, what does connecting a deadly pandemic to an American minority group say about education and critical thinking abilities among the general population?
Well, so one of the problems with hate crimes in general is that it engages a fallacy. And the fallacy is called generalizing from the particular, right? It's you see a black cat once and you have bad luck. So you think that every time you're going to see a black cat, you're going to have bad luck. You know, spit on your baseball glove in order to win the World Series. And then you want to do that every single time. So bigotry is in the same category of superstition. You think this one thing about this one Asian person, or you have this one experience with this black person, or what have you, and then you think it's true of everybody. And so there's just something fundamentally logically flawed about bigotry and discrimination, and hate crimes are examples of that. And I also want to say the phrase hate crime can be a little misleading. Because I think a lot of our listeners are going to say, you know, I don't hate Asians. I don't hate African Americans. I don't hate anybody. I love everybody. And so I'll actually tell you a little story. It was quite a few years ago. In Grand Forks, there was a Mongolian barbecue. It's a different one that is here now. It's family owned, very small. And then it closed all of a sudden. And I was taking a walk with a friend of mine who was my age and who was born and raised in central North Dakota. And I mentioned how sad it was that I liked the restaurant. And she said, I heard they were serving dog. And I said, they weren't serving dog. And she said, well, why would people say that then? I said, because they're racist, right? And then we sort of talked about that, and I sort of laughed about the comment. But this idea that gets associated with Asian people, that they serve dog because in some cultures and some Asian cultures, dog was a reasonably common food, particularly for the poor folks. They assume that all meat, or they talk about it as if all meat is that. And that permeates a community, right? But this is where the logic fails, because this was a restaurant that was, you know, in addition to wanting to earn money, they also have to get meat from local suppliers, and they have to be inspected, and people are going to know the taste of things. And so all evidence suggests that they weren't serving dog, but people are inclined to believe it because they have these illogical associations with Asians. And so the word hate in hate crime, I think, doesn't do justice to the breadth of experience that we have to engage in when we talk about bigotry, discrimination, stereotyping, and hate crimes in general.
So is there any logic behind this? It seems like you're hinting at there might be, but is this a nature or nurture reaction? What's sort of the root that makes us look at some people differently?
I think if anything is innate about this, it's the us versus them instinct, right? Human beings are tribal creatures. We evolved to be tribal. And almost all of our political fissures and almost all of our suspicions revolve around an us-them axis, right? And so we're good, they're bad. We're trustworthy, they're not. And the nurture aspect, the cultural aspect, is what us and them, how that's defined, right? Different cultures are going to define us in different ways and them in different ways. And not just because different cultures or different ethnicities or different skin tones or different religions, but also because different cultures prioritize different things, right? Us may be, a Minnesota Wild fan, right? Us may be a redhead. Us may be a UND student, right? Us can be anything. And so depending on the history of your region, depending on the history of your family, depending on the history of your culture, the us and them gets defined differently. And Asians have always been a them in American culture. Asians have always been an other, as the term has been used. And we like to think that we're past that. We like to think that we're above that, but clearly we're not. And so at times of insecurity, that us-them thing kicks in to a higher degree because people are trying to protect themselves, and it gets aimed at this general population who were just as lovely and generous and kind and interesting and awful and suspicious and as any other group.
The Asian American community reminds us that the recent spike in reported hate crime incidents goes along with an extensive history of discrimination, going back to immigration quotas. We needed a railroad, but internment camps. We were fighting the Japanese, and oh, we've got these people who are somewhat Japanese in California. This is generations old. When does it become just stupid?
Well, it was always stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the worst and most dangerous terms is normal. And I don't mean that it's bad to have a cultural norms and expectations, but we think things are logical or they make sense because they're familiar to us. And so this otherness of the Asian population just sort of makes sense to some people. They look at a group of people and they think they look differently than me. They have different food than me. They have a different language than me. So they're other. You know, the other complication with Asian statistics in particular is that Asian means a bunch of different things,
yeah.
right? There's East Asian, right? Japanese and Chinese and Koreans. There's South Asian, which are Indians and Pakistanis and Bangladeshis. There's Central Asian, which is folks from the Central Soviet Republic, and Mongolia. And so the very idea of associating all these people is about the continent and about the region, not about the people themselves. So, you know, this is one of the difficulties. One of the difficulties is if you call someone from India the same group or the same term that you call someone from Japan or Korea, there's something weird about that, and there's something artificial about that. And so it's some of it is just stupid, right? As you suggest in the beginning, some of it is habit and some of it is convenience, because we do often use these terms just because it's easier to say these terms and to describe people or groups in these terms. And so you have to always be aware that all of these ideas and all these concepts and all these terms are shortcuts for a much larger concept that needs to be unpacked.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which you hear on the Prairie Public Network once a month. We're inaugurating a new program element today we call Philosophical Currents. We'll take current events out of the headlines and talk about the sort of the philosophy behind the issue and maybe how we can move beyond it. Jack, your area of specialization is political philosophy. So let's talk about lip service, the politics of saying something that supposedly ameliorates, makes sounds good, but doesn't do anything, and dog whistles, which we've had plenty of in the last few years.
Because these ideas are, you know, instantiated in the language, because, as I was saying before, that the terminology is a shortcut, we often think that if we alter the language, it resolves the problem. We often think that if we only say the right thing, it changes the equation. And that can be true, and it often is not true. It's not true when someone is giving lip service and when someone is just saying something to avoid being attacked or to hide their true feelings. But it can be true, particularly when a marginalized group takes words that were slurs or weapons and reclaims them for their own use. So the word queer for a long time was a slur against homosexuals, and now the queer community very proudly calls themselves that, right? Many folks who listen are old enough to recognize that Black Americans for a while were called colored, and that was the acceptable term. And then they were called Negro, which was the acceptable term. And then they were called Afro-Americans and then Black and then African-Americans and now people of color, although that's a larger category. And so all of that is a way of the group saying, you keep pointing to us as if we're a bad thing, but we're actually a good thing, and we're proud of ourselves. We have pride, not in the sense that we're superior to anyone. That's the difference between, say, Asian pride and white pride or white supremacy, is that in white supremacy, people think that being white is better than other things. But for something like Asian pride, it's about saying, all my life, people have said what I am is negative, it's ugly, it's sexualized, it's all these other things. And none of that is true. I'm just proud of who I am, and I'm comfortable with who I am, and I want to assert that who I am is good, not bad. And so because some of this is a problem of language, the language either exacerbates the problem, can be used as a weapon, or can be a healing aspect and can take us to the next stage where we can really look at the conceptual ideas.
Well, you talked about language. I can think of a couple of phrases that have been grossly overworked in recent years: cancel culture and political correctness. Sometimes at odds with each other, but they're sort of a shorthand for what I feel and why I feel it.
So the problem with those terms is that while they have some real descriptive power of what's happening in the world. There is a certain kind of cancel culture right now that we can talk about. It's also used as a weapon. It's also used to delegitimize people who want a more diverse and just society. So let me just take a simple example. Lots of people know, and we were inundated with the idea that Dr. Seuss was being canceled, right? And, you know, how awful it is, and cancel culture and cancel culture and cancel culture. But Dr. Seuss wasn't canceled. What happened was the estate of Dr. Seuss, his descendants who own the rights to the book, it's their books, it's their property. There were a couple books, very unpopular books, as it turned out, very rarely read books, that depicted Asian Americans very negatively. They used stereotypical language and they used stereotypical images. And the estate said, hey, these are our books and they're old fashioned and they don't communicate the message that Dr. Seuss is supposed to communicate. So we are going to stop publishing this stuff that we own. Now, that's not cancel culture. That's rational, you know, thoughtful ways of thinking about the world. There are certainly words that I have used and certainly things that I have written at one time that I thought, you know what? Ooh, I don't want that out there. I've outgrown it and I just don't want it there anymore. And so when you look at what actually happened with Dr. Seuss, it was a minor thing with tremendous meaning. But what the opponents of, you know, very conservative and Fox News pundits tried to do was talk about that in terms of censorship and oppression and cancel culture. And so I'm always really careful about using those phrases because while they do have core meanings that are useful, more often than not, they're just weapons to delegitimize a whole spectrum of points of view.
Race, ethnicity, gender, religion, always we can define and conquer, I suppose, is one way to put it. But why do we do it? Why? What's the impulse to do that?
I actually want to sort of answer a sub-question that was implicit in that. Because, of course, why we do it is out of habit. Why we do it is that us and them. Why we do it is because it's politically expedient. But I think the interesting question that comes from what you're asking is sort of the inverse, which is if we don't want to divide and conquer, if we don't want to be racist, then why have these group-focused ideas like hate crimes, right? Why do we consistently talk about, analyze, and punish crimes of certain races or certain ethnicities or religions more than others, right? And the answer is actually really interesting. After World War II, when the Nazis were being tried for their crimes, there was no category to describe what they had done, right? There was no category to describe the systematic attempt to destroy, using industry, an entire people. And so the international legal community invented two terms. The first was genocide. Genocide is a legal term, didn't exist before. And the second was crime against humanity. And the idea of a crime against humanity is that there's crimes that are so large and that are of a certain type that they're not just crimes against the individual victim. They're also crimes against the people who the individual victims have certain relationships to. In the case of crime against humanity, it's all people. When you commit genocide against an entire people, you're victimizing the entire human race. And so what happens with hate crimes is we want to say two things. We want to say there are individual victims who are the victims of slurs or abuse or violence or theft or other things. But we also want to say that these crimes are so big and of a certain type that run counter to the very core of our democracy, right? The core of our democracy is that we welcome difference of opinion, difference of experience, different race, different nations. We welcome difference. And when you commit a crime because of a person's background, when you commit a bias crime, which is the other term that it's called, or a hate crime, you're not just victimizing the individual, you're victimizing everyone who shares whatever characteristic the individual has that you're attacking. And so the idea of hate crimes and bias crimes is a direct consequence of the lessons we learned from World War II, which is there are some crimes that are larger than the individual victim, and they're larger than the named people. It's also the group. And sometimes that group is the whole human race, but sometimes that group is Asians or Sikhs or Jews or what have you.
And if we look at today's headlines, African Americans, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer accused in the murder of George Floyd, which caused a worldwide eruption of reaction when it happened last May. Part of that would seem to be, if you look at a legislature, if you look at Congress, it does not reflect the greater society. It's mostly older white guys. And that gets to another political philosopher's question here. In a democratic society, how might a philosopher's approach ensure the rights of minority populations while respecting the authority of majority rule?
It's a really, really good and really tough question in some areas, right? What are the limits of free speech? That's a really rich question. What are the limits of gun rights? That's a really interesting question. The question of protecting individual minorities involves, and you'll recognize this phrase, not erasing the people we're talking about. So for example, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to think for a second that I'm criticizing you, but for example, we're talking about Asian hate crimes, and you logically bring up Black Lives Matter stuff and the things that happened in Minneapolis. And the proper response to that from a political point of view is that stuff is really important and we need to talk about that. But right now we're talking about Asians. And so what's happening in our culture at this very moment for really ugly reasons is we're talking about Asian victims and Asian hate crimes. Then we can talk about these other things. And if you can do that, if you can say, let's talk about this group, then we'll talk about this group, then we'll talk about this group, and we're not prioritizing one as more important than another, we are saying right now that's what's in the news. Right now this is the most urgent question. Then we start to recognize the fact that what we call a minority is actually a majority.
We're all coalitions, ultimately.
That's not only absolutely right, I think that's a beautiful way of saying it. We're all coalitions.
Well, we run against the clock. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, monthly on Prairie Public's radio network, and this new element for Main Street, Philosophical Currents. Jack, it's always a pleasure.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, a new book for teachers to apply lessons in the classroom that actually work. It's called The Startup Teacher Playbook. We'll hear about it after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has voted to turn a bill that would require a high school student to compete in sporting events based on the gender of the student's birth into a study. That potentially sets up a conference committee on the measure. The House earlier passed the original bill, House Bill 1298. Fargo Republican Senator Kristen Roars offered the amendment.
What's the rush? Why do we need to pass this law today? We don't know that there's this rash of issues going on. And why can't we study it? Why can't we take the time to say what would the impacts be, whether they be financial, whether they be behavioral health, whether they be on the competitive ability of the females?
Edinburgh Republican Senator Jana Myrdal argued for the original bill.
I would urge this assembly to vote nay on this amendment, because this amendment does nothing and it'll never go to a study. We all know that. It's just kicking the can down the road, and I would urge a do pass on the most common sense legislation we've seen so far.
The amendment was adopted on a verification vote, meaning the vote board was dark and members who voted for or against it are not revealed. Once that happened, Myrdal asked the senators to vote yes to get it into a conference committee. Bismarck police are investigating a late-night shooting that happened yesterday around 11 p.m. Officers responded to the 1600 block of Mapleton Avenue after reports of gunfire. Two individuals had gunshot wounds and were taken to a local hospital. Their conditions have not yet been released. Bismarck police believe this to be a targeted attack on the two victims, and there does not appear to be any further threat to the public at this time. And House and Senate leadership are split over whether to add money to the K-12 per pupil formula. Governor Burgum's budget suggested flat funding for the next 2 years. Some legislators would like to see that increase by 1% per year. House Majority Leader Chad Pollard says he would leave it flat because schools will be receiving federal money from the coronavirus aid packages.
And with all the money that's going to come through that, you know, I question why we need to do the one-on-one.
Pollard says that federal money cannot be built into ongoing expenses. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says he would support a one-on-one plan. He says the feds are requiring a maintenance of effort for school funding.
One-on-one would fill that requirement as far as the feds are concerned.
Wardner says the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, Senator Don Shibley of Mott, is pushing for the one-on-one plan. Wardner says there is money in the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund to cover that cost. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Darcy Buckegaard followed the path of most school teachers. She went to college for a teaching degree, taught for years, and over those years attended many teacher training sessions, often required for professional development. Buckegaard found some of the teacher training fell short when it came to applying the ideas in a classroom. So she co-authored a book. The Startup Teacher Playbook aims to turn ideas into action. She spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg.
I think most teachers, most humans, are naturally curious people. And I, at least, always wanted to get better at the art and the science of teaching so I could do a better job for my students. But so often, unfortunately, I sat in professional development and sometimes felt like I could be dusting my classroom and that might be more productive for me to get ready for the school year than sitting in this auditorium where one person lectured to 300 teachers. Like literally the way teachers are told, don't teach this way, right? Don't lecture. Don't pretend that everyone in your audience needs exactly the same thing. So I would sit there and be taught as a professional the way we as professionals are told not to teach. And even in the best circumstances, professional development would get me really fired up. I mean, legit inspired of like, oh my gosh, I need to, this is so exciting. I have so many ideas. But the reality of teaching is you go to a training or a workshop, and then the next day you're back in the classroom. And so when do you ever have time to actually take those ideas and get them into the classroom? So as I transitioned from the classroom to designing professional development for teachers, my main thrust was always, I want the kind of professional development that helped me actually implement things into the classroom. And so through a series of workshops that I did, actually through Prairie Public in my time as the teacher ambassador at Prairie Public, I started using a series of tools. And I met this woman, Michelle Blanchett, and she and I were both talking about our professional development woes. And she said, well, I've always had this idea for a book. And we started talking and I was like, oh, that's really similar to some of the stuff that I've been doing. And it evolved from there. And we designed a series of tools, activities, and this whole play-by-play, we hope, instructional coach in book form that helps teachers take all of the ideas, the inspiration that they're getting from anywhere, from professional development, from Twitter, from Instagram, from watching videos, from listening to a colleague, and turn all of those ideas into solutions for problems that they're having in the classroom. And so the whole book was really born out of our own frustration as classroom teachers, wanting to do more to improve ourselves as educators, but more importantly, wanting to be more focused on redesigning the learning process so it was better for our students.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people about why New Year's resolutions don't work. And, you know, people are all gung-ho. You go to the gym the first 2 weeks of January, and yep. it's just always full. And then by mid-February, it's back to, you know, the regular.
Back to normal.
But you can't sustain that kind of enthusiasm. And it sounds like because they aren't really given the tools to implement it.
Right. The tools, there's so many layers for teachers that kind of act as hidden barriers to innovation. And innovation is such a buzzword in education. So kind of like a New Year's resolution in a way, like we need to innovate. Mm-hmm. And like we get all excited about the idea of innovating, but no one provides the how to innovate. No one provides a structure to innovate. There's very little time devoted for innovation, like, okay, we're literally going to go through this design process and we're going to try to find a solution to something that's not currently working. The talk right now is really just, well, we need to innovate. We need to have business ready and entrepreneurial thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be teaching that to students. We need to be teaching them design thinking. We need to be teaching them all of these things.
Right. So you're given a bunch of buzzwords and that's it.
A bunch of buzzwords, right. But no structure, no support. And what's even more difficult, another hidden barrier, in addition to the time and the structure, teachers in general aren't trained in things like design thinking, human-centered design, like the engineering process. All of this buzz that we need to be teaching students entrepreneurial thinking and these 21st century skills, they're not skills that in college, like in teacher preparatory programs, they're not things that teachers are trained to do. And then so much of the process of doing, of becoming a teacher, unfortunately, can from time to time kill some of your initial joy and curiosity. And I say this knowing that this all sounds very harsh. And I want to be clear that I love teaching. I was so lucky to teach in amazing school districts. I do not envy the people who are trying to craft, but they're trying to craft professional development for, you know, 2,000 teachers, all of whom need different things. But they also have all of these mandates that they're required to do. So there are so many requirements and so many hurdles at every level. Mm. So I understand all of that. Teaching is an art. It's a science. There's pedagogy and there is good curriculum and there are things that are the science of teaching. But if you watch a really great teacher teach, or if you think back to that teacher that you just adored mm-hmm. when you were in school, you loved them not because of the science of teaching. You loved because of the art that they brought to their craft of teaching. And sometimes all of those mandates, all those things we have to do can really get in the way of that art, that autonomy, that feeling as a teacher, like I get to craft solutions to the educational challenges that the kids in front of me are having. And that was something that I always struggled with. You know, my job is to serve these people who are in front of me right now. And so frequently the one size fits all solutions just don't work. And that can get really demoralizing as a teacher when you go into teaching to help. And then sometimes at the end of the day, I left the classroom feeling like I'm just not helping these kids because what I'm required to do isn't quite what they need. And I need the freedom. I need some power. I need some tool that helps me truly address and get to what these kids that are sitting in front of me need from me. I hope that some of the tools in this book can provide the inspiration for teachers to do that, but also the structure so that they can blend that science and the art of being a teacher into crafting those solutions for their students.
You and your co-author, Michelle, were very much drawn to the startup world. There's an article on Investopedia that says in 2019, the failure rate of startups was about 90%. So what is it about the startup world that you thought could be applicable in the classroom?
Yes, that's hard that 90% of those ventures fail. But I think we also have to take into consideration the volume that at least try. And there are so many times in the classroom where I think we as teachers, for whatever reason, from the own no's that we are telling ourselves, our lack of self-confidence, our lack of time, our lack of support, the external no's, the judgment of other teachers, the lack of funding, there are so many no's that can frequently prevent us from even trying. Because the reality is, as a teacher, if you do try something in the classroom, it is going to fail. Sometimes, you know, I can't count the number of times where I was so excited to try something. And then, you know, 7:45 in the morning, you start with period one and they just stare at you like you're an alien with chickens growing out of your head. And you very quickly go, well, that failed. That in this startup lingo, that was a startup idea that totally bombed. But the next period, I was able to make some tweaks and I got closer to that 30% success rate. And the next period, I was able to tweak a little bit further and got it so that it was pretty good. And most teachers, without even realizing it, are good at entrepreneurial thinking. We just don't think of it as entrepreneurial thinking, but we're constantly looking for feedback from our user, our customer, society, or those students sitting in front of us. And we're getting feedback and we're adapting and we're tweaking what we are providing so that we can better serve them. More importantly, some of the structures that the startup community have, there's the expectation of failing. Because of that statistic, there's no shame really in failing. We know a lot of startups are going to fail. We know a lot of ventures aren't going to get very far. So there's that mentality, that mindset of we continually try. And there's some of that in education. It's referred to the growth mindset, right? It's that you're not there yet. You're continuing to learn. And then the third thing that entrepreneurial, particularly the social entrepreneur thinking, people who are specifically designing solutions to societal challenges, they have a tool called the Business Model Canvas. And it's a simple one-page document that would allow people who have an idea of how they want to solve X problem in their community, right? Lack of food, access to fresh produce. And they're going to try to design a social entrepreneur business that, you know, makes money, but solves this social problem. And they have this simple one pager that helps them flesh out their idea, that asks them questions, that they can get feedback very quickly. So instead of having to do what I always thought businesses did, you know, you maybe see in TV shows from time to time, like a whole business plan, where it's pages of market research and all of this stuff. It's a pretty fast process. And Michelle, my co-author, she has more experience in that world. She was a social studies teacher. She did her master's degree on social entrepreneurship. And so the penny from that side was really, that contribution really came from her brain of her seeing this tool in action and watching social entrepreneurs use this and go, wow, like this happens so fast. They're just solving problems and they're seeing what's going to work and what's not going to work. And why don't we do that in education? We're really trying to show that it's not about education being a business. It's about taking the best tools and applying them to education so that we have the structure that right now just doesn't exist in any form.
Sounds like what you're trying to do is increase buy-in and desire on both ends of this from the students and the educators.
And I think that's part of a natural thing of teaching, right? There's another book that talks about making ideas sticky. As a teacher, you want the things that you're teaching to stick. You want your students to have buy-in. Otherwise, to some extent, what's the point? if they're not buying into this concept of what you're teaching, it's really not helping them. And so that's another example of a book that's more for the marketing world of making some ideas sticky that really does cross apply to education as a whole.
You talk about this ability to pivot quickly, and then you throw in something like a pandemic. One of my favorite ways to think about the pandemic is that it's a good time to rewrite our programming.
Absolutely.
How are you seeing your colleagues do that?
For me, the pandemic has opened this door of hope in a really weird way. I know that sounds awful given how atrocious this last year has been. But anytime there's a challenge, I'm one of those annoying people who has just decided to try to train my brain to see the possibilities anytime I'm confronted with problems. And it gets annoying if you're a colleague of mine, because I'm kind of constantly playing devil's advocate of, well, like, this does teach us this. But I truly think that the pandemic, A, has exposed a whole bunch of problems that people didn't fully recognize existed before. The lack of equitable access to technology. Some of the things that I don't think are as big of a problem, like the Fargo and West Fargo school districts, particularly, those are just two that I know, go to great lengths to make sure that their students have access to technology at home. And because we had some of that infrastructure already in place, just as the norm here, the transition to virtual and hybrid learning was a little bit easier. But that was not the case in a lot of places. So we're exposing some of the big gaps and the big deficits. Hopefully you have seen that this fall looked different virtually than last March did. Because you're right, teachers literally had to pivot. In some cases, schools were up and running within a weekend of going from in-person to virtual. We've shown that we can do this. So what is school, what is it for? Because we know that some of the social aspects that were so lacking because of distance and hybrid learning, and there were so many kids who were really hurting because they didn't have that safe environment, that comfortable continuity of the school environment and that love and the support and the care that they get there. That was really tragic for a lot of kids. So how can we really emphasize that element of school? How can we meld in some of these best things that we're figuring out from virtual learning? How can we continue to keep parents and caregivers involved in education in a way that is not as intense as it had to be during the pandemic? Because that's not fair. We know that most of the people who have left jobs during the pandemic are women who stayed home in order to basically be the teacher for their kid to help them stay in school. So we don't want that extreme. But I think there is a beauty that parents and guardians have been more involved and have like seen more of what their kids are doing. And there's just all this opportunity. So I'm very hopeful that we don't just flip a switch and say, well, we can just go back to normal.
Normal is just what we're used to, not what's right.
Exactly. So like instead of falling back to just, well, this is the way we've always done it. I am one of those people who always asks why. Well, this is what we do. And not in a judgmental way, just in a like, let's actually look at why are we doing what we're doing? What are some of the opportunities of having a more flexible high school schedule, particularly? What are the opportunities for internships that high school students could be, you know, doing school to work programs if we had a bit more flexibility? What if the word classroom meant something different? And we're hopeful that some of the tools, this educator canvas that we designed, our version of the business model canvas, helps people look at those opportunities where they can turn a problem into a possibility.
Well, you turned a problem into a possibility. You had this problem of being stuck in a hospital bed, being prepped for surgery while you're about to give birth to triplets. And this is when you decide to finish writing a book?
Well, that was more the pressure of, oh my goodness, like, this is actually happening. The book idea started almost exactly a year before my triplets were born. They're 15 months old now. So this has been a 2.5 year process almost that Michelle and I have been working on this, and we created an outline. And when we got the book contract, I had just found out I was pregnant. And then she and I made our initial outline. And a little while later, I found out that it was triplets. And so that changed the pace at which we started writing and designing. I did not draw the pictures. The book is very graphic heavy. It really relies on, there's a lot of activities that help people. We wanted this to be a book about application, not just a book about, oh, you need to do this. We wanted it to be a teach a man to fish type of book of like, here's how you can do this. So there's a lot of activities. So I designed the layout for a lot of these things. After we were creating the activity, I would design this layout. And so, yes, there was this sudden moment when they told me I got admitted to the hospital. And so I had 4 or 5 days where I got a lot of designing done because I couldn't. Yeah, they wouldn't let me out of bed. I just sat with my computer, and it was December of 2019, and it was just freezing. It was the week that it was just freezing cold mm-hmm, outside. Mm-hmm. So I just sat snug and designed all these page layouts. And then they told me in the morning, all right, today's the day. And for whatever reason, that was the reality of, oh, like, I'm not just pregnant with triplets. I'm actually going to have triplets. Uh-huh, uh-huh, like, yeah. They have to come out now. And uh-huh. That's really going to change what I'm able to accomplish. So, wow, I need to. So I got done a whole nother, like, chunk of designing some page layouts. That was our kind of first draft. And then there were a lot of middle of the night writing sessions. You know, I would nurse them and feed everybody at 10 o'clock. And then I would work from the time I put them down until they woke up next at like 2 or 3 in the morning. And so I would just work for this stretch because that's when it was quiet. That's mm-hmm. when, you know, there were no interruptions from the phone, from anyone. You know, everybody was sleeping.
Yeah, except you.
Except for me. Yeah. And then I would, you know, feed them again, and then I would go to bed. And more often than I can count, it was also grandparents coming over so I could get some stuff done.
Darcy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for taking the time to chat about education. And I hope that this book can be helpful to a couple of teachers. Yeah.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg in a conversation with Darcy Bakkegaard, co-author of the Startup Teacher Playbook. It's available at Amazon.com. Decoded 8 Book is next.
Catherine Gell thinks we need some innovation in what she calls the politics industry.
Where we're not just looking at candidates right now after this election, we're looking around and saying collectively, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, people across the ideological spectrum, how can we not do this again? How can we alter this trajectory we're on?
Here are some of her innovative ideas and how she thinks they would work this Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
Support for Decoded 8 Book is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Decoded 8 Book for March 29th. Winter is often slow to depart the Great Plains. By the end of March, travel can still be an icy challenge. On this date in 1911, the Bismarck Tribune reported an unfortunate accident. Cars were not yet common, and most people still traveled in horse-drawn vehicles. Mrs. William Baxter of Braddock was severely burned in an accident involving a sleigh. People often placed a jug of hot water on the floorboard of a sleigh as a foot warmer. In preparation for a trip to town, Mrs. Baxter wanted to warm the water of the jug they used, but the cork was stuck. So she placed the whole jug in the oven. When her husband had the horses hitched to the sleigh and was ready to go, Mrs. Baxter removed the jug from the oven. It had developed quite a head of steam, and when she moved it, the jug exploded. Mrs. Baxter was showered with boiling water. While her injuries were not expected to be permanent, she suffered considerable pain. Sleigh accidents were quite common. On March 10, 1910, the Ward County Independent reported that 3 women suffered minor injuries when their sleigh overturned and they were thrown out onto the snow. In 1916, the Reverend J.C. Jorgensen met with several difficulties when traveling to Dickinson in his sleigh. He said the roads were almost impassable. The horses became mired in the melting snowdrifts, and he had to stop several times to make repairs to his equipment. Being thrown from the sleigh was a common cause of injury. A large party was returning from church in New Ulm when the horses spooked and broke into a run. The sleigh tipped over when the horses turned sharply. The 10 passengers were thrown out, lucky to suffer only minor injuries. Some sleigh accidents were deadly. In 1884, the Bismarck Tribune reported on a fatal accident in Pennsylvania. Two men were thrown over an embankment and killed when their sleigh crashed. In another Pennsylvania accident, a large party was returning home from a dance when their sleigh was hit by a train. Two people were killed and a dozen others injured. It's easy to romanticize traveling by sleigh. That mode of transportation, however, did come with its own set of dangers. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Getting evicted during the pandemic can risk a person's health and make it difficult to find a new place to live.
I literally had to sleep in my car. This is outrageous that this is going on in the United States of America.
With a federal order that prevents evictions set to expire, millions of tenants could be left unprotected. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, in the late 1970s, the founders of the National Conservative Political Action Committee tried new methods of raising money to win elections. In 1980, one of the PAC's targets was South Dakota U.S. Senator George McGovern. On our show on Tuesday, Mark C. Johnson talks about his new book, Tuesday Night Massacre, Four Senate Elections and the Radicalization of the Republican Party, with Lori Walsh, host of South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.